It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We unpack former President Donald Trump's legal battles now as the criminally indicted candidate seeks the Republican nomination to return to the White House. We examine where these investigations stand in multiple states. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ankush Kodori is a lawyer in Washington, D.C., a contributing editor for New York Magazine and a contributing writer for Politico Magazine. Ankush, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So by the numbers, former President Donald Trump facing two civil lawsuits and criminal charges in four cases. Which of these cases is the most consequential?
I think it's the Justice Department's 2020 election case, the criminal case that they filed in D.C. concerning Trump's efforts to kind of overturn the 2020 election. It's a complicated question when people kind of ask which is the most important or which is the most serious. There are a lot of different ways to sort of measure it or to try to assess that. But that's sort of where I come out based on what I think is sort of the importance of the case to the country, quite honestly, and also sort of the likelihood of a conviction and the likelihood of that conviction being sustained and potentially resulting in a term of imprisonment.
You've written about the legal risks of bringing criminal charges against a former president. What are the risks for an agency like the U.S. Department of Justice?
Well, I mean, the principal risk is that, like, they could actually lose these cases. And I think at that point, you know, they've sort of broken a seal here, which a lot of people were clamoring for. I support it myself, meaning the decision to bring criminal charges if prosecutors believe that they are appropriate. But of course, that had never happened before in our country. And if these cases sort of unravel or if there's a mistrial or an acquittal, I think an acquittal is extremely unlikely, but a mistrial is very much, I think, in the realm of possibility. It's going to look very bad for the department. It's going to look like they got out over their skis, that there was a politicized effort, that they misjudged the situation. And that's like sort of way down the line and somewhat hypothetical. But those are the sorts of things that people have been worried about and the sort of prospect that these sorts of prosecutions might become more routine.
What about these prosecutions and the timing of trials? How does that fit into the 2024 presidential campaign and what Trump is capable of doing in campaigning, but also facing these courtroom battles?
Yeah, I mean, this is the most remarkable aspect of these cases, which is that, you know, the political and legal paths, if you will, or sort of avenues, are like fully intertwined in Trump's case, right? These trials are currently scheduled across March and May, the DC case, the New York criminal case, the Florida criminal case concerning the documents at Mar-a-Lago. And those dates overlap with Republican primary dates. Those are dates that are right in the 2020 campaign season, preceding just even the nominating convention for the GOP, which will be in August. So, you know, all of this is occurring sort of simultaneously, and it all sort of heightens the risk and sort of the uncertainty surrounding it. But in terms of Trump and his approach, right, I think the simplest way to sort of understand what Trump is trying to do in terms of his legal strategy is his principal legal strategy is winning re-election, right? That is the thing that will sort of allow him to extricate himself most easily from at least the federal cases and possibly the state cases, at least while he is in office. So in order to do that, and we can get into this, I'm sure, he's sort of engaging in a bunch of delay tactics, trying to sort of throw various forms of gears in the sand, because his principal objective, I think, is to push these cases off and hope that he gets back in office.
We're talking about the indictments against former President Trump with Ankush Kodori. He's a lawyer, writer, former federal prosecutor. You can join in with your questions and comments. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ankush, Wisconsin Congressman Glenn Grothman called the FBI raid of Trump's home in August 2022 a blatant politicization of the Justice Department. And then last month, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson criticizes Trump's indictment by the Justice Department and said, quote, leftists are destroying America. Is there evidence of political motivation behind the federal charges against Trump?
No, no. There's no indication I see of a political bias playing a role. And I think that's the key thing, right? I mean, anytime you're talking about an investigation, now prosecutions concerning a prominent political figure, the most prominent political figure, a former president, there's politics in the mix, right? There are political implications, there are political effects. It's going to attract political attention. But the question that I think people really want to ask when they're sort of talking about the making those sorts of comments is there evidence that there was partisan bias that influenced the Justice Department's decision? Maybe even a desire to get a leg up in the 2024 election. I don't see that. And I've reported extensively on Merrick Garland. I wrote a profile about him for Politico early this year. And I think actually it's the claims of Senator Johnson and others are sort of backwards. I mean, the Justice Department did not want to be prosecuting Donald Trump. That was very clear when Biden took office. It was clear to me, given the sort of comments that Merrick Garland said. And it's been provided during confirmation and the like, and it has become increasingly clear with reporting from major media outlets, including a story from the Washington Post that basically concluded that the Justice Department did nothing significant on the 2020 Trump election case until like a year and a half. So, you know, and then the documents case, the raid of Mar-a-Lago and all of the sort of controversy around that, the Justice Department gave Trump many opportunities to provide those documents short of a search. He could have just complied with the subpoena, right? Like all he had to do is comply with the subpoena. There would have been no search of Mar-a-Lago. So, and he didn't comply and in fact, allegedly obstructed the effort to comply with that subpoena. So I think there was a lot of, excited commentary surrounding the search of Mar-a-Lago that I think has not held up well over time at all.
And just to understand here, so there's the special counsel Jack Smith, looking into the sensitive documents found at Mar-a-Lago. But then there in Manhattan, the DA is also, has charges of falsifying business records. So I wonder just like how do the indictments in Manhattan contrast to what's going on with the Mar-a-Lago documents?
Yeah, I mean, I think the indictment it's a very different set of facts.
Okay.
Very different set of facts, right? The facts that are at issue in the criminal case in New York concern Donald Trump's payments to the adult film star Stormy Daniels in the run-up to the 2016 election. Mm-hmm. And the charge is that he falsified business records within the Trump organization that concerned the purpose of that payment, that they were concealed and described internally as payments for legal services, when in fact they were payments to keep Stormy Daniels quiet and payments that continued through, I think, early 2017 or past the election for sure. And so the facts are very different, even though they both involve documents. In terms of sort of the legal parameters of the case, also quite different. I believe the charges at issue in New York, if I remember correctly, have 4-year terms of imprisonment as the maximum possible penalty. But I think most people, myself included, who have some experience in the New York courts, tend to assume that even if he were convicted on that case, it's quite unlikely he would serve a prison term, given the nature of the offense and how New York sort of approaches these cases. Of course, we can't say that definitively, given where we are and what, you know, he hasn't even been convicted yet and all that. But they're quite different in my mind. Okay. And I think the case in New York, and I've written about this too, is legally, I guess I would say, a little more adventurous in terms of the way the prosecutors have used the statutes. And I think Trump has more viable legal defenses and even to some extent factual defenses than he appears to have in the case in Florida.
Ankush Kadori, former federal prosecutor, now contributing editor for New York Magazine, analysis on the wave of criminal and civil legal cases into former President Donald Trump. You can be part of the conversation to ask a question, share your views. Call in at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get up to speed on the multiple indictments at the state and federal levels against former President Donald Trump and Trump standing trial in the thick of the 2024 presidential campaign. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ankush Kadori is our guide, contributing editor to New York Magazine, former federal prosecutor. Ankush, we heard from John, called in from Menominee with a question. We'd like to hear about the legal issues regarding the application of the 14th Amendment and how it applies to former President Trump. What are your insights there?
Oh, gosh, good question. So there's been a recent effort on the part of some advocacy groups and some political groups to argue that Donald Trump is ineligible to run for office, constitutionally ineligible, under a provision of the 14th Amendment that prohibits people from holding public office if they engage in insurrection or a rebellion against the United States or aided enemies of the country. And so the argument that many people are making now is that Trump's role in the effort to overturn the 2020 election, role in January 6th, all qualifies as engaging in insurrection, that he's therefore disqualified under the 14th Amendment. I'm not particularly persuaded by this theory, but that's the theory. It has a lot of wrinkles to it historically, very, very limited case law interpreting it. There's now a huge sort of debate that's going on in legal circles about the history and the implications. But I think the short of it for folks listening is that a couple of things would need to happen for this to actually really have some relevance to the 2024 election. People would have to, and some of these cases are underway, but courts would have to conclude that Trump is in fact ineligible on certain states' ballots. And that could then go up to the Supreme Court for them to review. And my own view, just given the way the Supreme Court is currently composed, is that it's quite unlikely that they would disqualify Trump under that theory. But of course, nothing is certain in this area. But that's sort of the general lay of the land.
Well, as we look at constitutional amendments, what about the First Amendment and freedom of speech? If you know, untruthful denial of election results becomes a crime or spreading falsehoods about elections, does that have implications for First Amendment rights?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certainly a First Amendment issues that are implicated, particularly by the DC case on the 2020 election. And I think prosecutors, though, have done a capable or at least sufficient job of distinguishing simply political speech from the actions that political speech were designed to bring about. And, you know, if you think about like financial fraud, right? Maybe you've gotten a phone call recently from some scammer in some other part of the world who tried to get you to give them their your iCloud password or your Gmail password or some credit card number. That's speech too, right? Mm-hmm. The conduct that, you know, you're being victimized by is speech, but it's criminal, right? Because of the nature of the speech and what it is trying to accomplish. So it's really not enough just to say like that there's speech involved. There are all types of, you know, when someone stops you on the street, God forbid, and says, I got a gun in my pocket, give me your wallet or give me your purse, that's speech too, right? Even if the person doesn't have a gun on them, and it's still a crime. So it's a little subtler than just, you know, there's speech involved. And I think it's, you know, not surprising that Trump's lawyers have seized on it, but like a lot of their arguments, they don't quite, I don't find them terribly compelling.
Let's go to Ross in Soldiers Grove now. Ross, hi.
Hi, good morning. I've been, like many people, reading, and most of my information comes from the newspaper and through the news. And I know that there's a bunch of different cases. There's the New York fraud, the New York, the thing with the tech or the campaign. There's the Mar-a-Lago and the documents. There's the trying to overturn election. And a lot of this gets kind of blurry, but the question I'm kind of wondering about is, he seems like a, and you forgive me because you'll probably detect my bias, but it seems like as if they're like trying to prosecute a mob boss. When I think back of like the name of the mob boss that were ultimately all they got him was on tax fraud, but there was this thought that he had done all this stuff. Is it really going to be about do the prosecutors need, or do they have information that they can say, oh, yeah, we've seen Trump has done this, versus like, well, we have to roll a bunch of his employees to build this case.
Ross, thank you. Ankush, what is your perspective there?
It's a very good question. So I would say that in terms of like the case that has the most, I think, readily accessible, maybe even the most potent, easily understandable facts is the Mar-a-Lago case. And I think particularly, you know, that case charges Trump not with just holding on to those documents, but obstructing the Justice Department's effort to get them back. He does not appear to have particularly good defenses to the obstruction charges. But let me want to say one thing about sort of the concern about like there being so many kind of prosecutors on the scene having descended on Trump at once, because I think a lot of people have that same exact sort of feeling and maybe even anxiety or concern that maybe this is sort of coordinated or it's overreach to some extent. I think about it more like we're in the middle of kind of this very strange constitutional car crash because I think what happened is, if you kind of look at the broad sweep and where the Justice Department was and where the state prosecutors were over the last few years, the Justice Department was not actively investigating Trump for the first year or two of the Biden administration. And so what was happening was that you had these state prosecutors in New York and in Georgia who I think felt like they had a responsibility to their own constituents to pursue conduct that was apparently not being addressed by the Justice Department in their view. But that had occurred within their boundaries. So they move forward with their investigations and ultimately their cases. Meanwhile, the Justice Department sort of belatedly arrives on the scene, in my view, largely, I think, because the January 6th committee sort of shamed them into doing it. But, you know, last November was the appointment of the special counsel. And so all of this stuff sort of collided at once. And I think people are it's a very understandable reaction. Not only the fact that these cases are sort of blurring together, but to really ask, like, how did this happen? Really, what's going on? But that's sort of my assessment.
We're talking about the indictments against former President Trump with Ankush Kadori. He's a lawyer, writer, former federal prosecutor. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Georgia with the racketeering charges. And we saw this week former campaign Trump attorney Kenneth Chesbro becoming one of three co-defendants to plead guilty in the case. What do these guilty pleas mean for the case against Trump in Georgia?
So anytime a defendant in a large multi-defendant case pleads out, it's not good news for the lead defendant, who in this case is Trump, right? Prosecutors want to try to sort of build a wall of evidence in a trial, and each sort of plea deal, each cooperator is like another brick in the wall of evidence. So it's helpful to prosecutors. That said, all of these plea deals were quite favorable. No one is going to serve any prison time. That it's in the low thousands of dollars in terms of fines for each of them. And they pled to fairly discrete types of crimes within the broad ambit of the indictment. So I'll just give you one example. Sidney Powell, her guilty plea appears to have been in connection with an incursion into Georgia's election systems after January 6th. That conduct does not appear, at least based on the public record, to have much connection to Trump himself. So it's not clear that, and the other plea deals have the same sort of structure to them, different sort of very discrete elements of the case that don't necessarily suggest, like they haven't pled guilty to the conspiracy charges. Like nobody has pled guilty to the main charge in the case, which is the RICO conspiracy, right? So here too, we kind of just got to like take it one step at a time. But, you know, this is positive momentum for the prosecutors. It's bad news for Trump. But not quite as bad as I think the press, some people in the press are portraying it at the moment.
In our last minute together, I want to ask you about these gag orders. Yesterday, former President Trump fined $10,000 for violating a gag order. What do you make of them?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of controversy with the gag orders, right? In D.C., there's an effort to sort of litigate a gag order that's ongoing. Look, I think what has happened in the New York court in that fraud case seems to be very reasonable in terms of the judge's assessment. I mean, I was quite taken aback by what happened yesterday, even as someone who is, you know, following this stuff for years. I mean, Trump had to take the stand and answer questions about the comments that were at issue yesterday. And he basically lied, I think, on the stand. And that's at least that was the judge's conclusion. And that's what led to the fine. If he keeps it up, they're going to be increasing fines. The dollar amounts are going to go up. Conceivably, there could be imprisonment, although I think that's not really in the proximate future in any of these cases. Yeah, I think the fines are going to go up, and he may actually finally just realize that he should keep his mouth shut. That would be the first time in his life that I think he would come to that conclusion. But this is not helping him, violating this and having to pay all this money.
Ankush, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Ankush Kadori is a lawyer in Washington, a contributing editor for New York Magazine, contributing writer for Politico Magazine. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.